Hi there, listener. This is Cass. I want to check in with you all before we get started on this week's episode. We are discussing Stephen King's It and related properties. So, a full list of content warnings for you regarding this episode. Some of these are passing mentions. Some of these are things which are lingered upon more in discussion. Child murder, parental abuse and medical abuse, suicide, homophobia, gay bashing, racism, the magical Native American trope, fat phobia, HIV and the AIDS epidemic, forced outing, and misogyny. If any of these are topics that make you uncomfortable or potentially trigger you, it is not worth sitting through the episode to listen to them. We do keep it relatively lighthearted here, but at the same time, I want you to take care of yourself. And if this episode isn't for you, then it isn't for you. If you're interested but can't listen to that kind of stuff, a transcript will eventually follow. Additional editorial note, I do just want to note that I mispronounced Ben's last name throughout the entirety of the episode. His last name is Han, H-A-N scum, Han scum, not Ham scum. N's and M's are very difficult for me to differentiate, and honestly, it may not make that much of a difference, but I did just want to note it. Anyway, I want to thank you so much for listening and supporting us. And without further ado, let's get into the episode. Hi, my name is Cass.
And my name is Tease.
And welcome to Author's Note.
Don't like, don't listen.
Tease, how are you doing this week?
Cass, I'm great. How about you?
I'm good.
Are you?
I have a feeling I know why you're doing great.
Why am I doing great?
Would you like to share with the audience why you're doing great, Tease?
Is there something that I'm missing here?
Nay?
No.
Nay?
Nay. Oh! Nay! Guys, great news! Season 2 of Uma Musume Pretty Derby got announced! I'm so happy
for you.
So happy. Horse is coming back, which means that there's a bigger chance of Horse English version of the Tap Tap games coming to the States, which means that I can hang out with Horse. That means more Horse content. That means more Horse merch. I actually don't own any Horse merch, surprisingly. But
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why do you call it Horse?
Because I just shorten everything. I'm too lazy to type out Uma Musume every time I talk about it. So
okay, but what is Horse the shortened form? Like Horse, obviously, but where does the arse come from?
Horse. I just say horse weird sometimes. Like sometimes I say burse instead of purse. Or banch.
I like that.
Instead of bench. So sometimes I just say horse.
Banch is good.
Banch. I love banch. I think it's so funny.
Love to sit on a good banch.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you got a big old burse. It works. Horse.
Tease.
Yeah.
You watched anything good this week?
So I actually rewatched Jennifer's Body for the first time in a few weeks.
Want to watch that. I've never seen it.
Oh, shrimp arresting.
But it's been all over my timeline on Twitter lately. I don't know why. It's because it's the spooky season.
So, do you want Tease's hot opinion?
Yes.
I didn't like it the first time I watched it, but okay. It's definitely better to watch with friends. And
I can see that.
You just gotta follow along for the ride. You know, you just gotta go along for the ride when it comes to this movie. And Diablo Cody is the same person who wrote Juno. And she wrote Thule, and I've never seen Thule. And she also was uncredited for some of the Evil
Thule,
Dead remake.
Like Tallulah?
Yeah, like T-U-L-L-Y. It came out like 2 years ago.
Oh, no, that's not the movie I'm thinking of.
No. And I think she's done a few other small writing gigs, but she's best known for Juno. So some of the vocabulary said by these characters have never been said in real life by teenagers.
I love that, though.
It's
There's
really
something
funny.
About that
yeah.
that creates, like, its own world.
Mm-hmm.
And it both feels very... It feels very fake and artificial, but at the same time so real. It's almost like an adjacent universe. Like, if you just took one step over, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, the arsler is said multiple times in it.
Yikes.
And Chris Pratt is in it for 30 whole seconds. But it's kind of fun. I'll cut
those 30 seconds out. I can do without seeing Chris Pratt.
Yeah, it's kind of sexy and fun. And what's really unfortunate about this movie, the reason why it flopped so badly in theaters, was because it was marketed more towards teenage boys who thought Megan Fox was hot because of the Transformers movies. But the real demographic it should have been aimed towards was, like, the Mean Girls crowd, like teenagers mm-hmm. and gays. And it did really, really poorly because not a lot of people thought it was what it actually was because of marketing.
That's always really frustrating when you go to see a movie and it's not what mm-hmm. you think. And then you end up hating it sort of passively because it's not what you were promised.
And now it has this huge cult following because people are finally realizing what it's supposed to be. So, I would say give it a listen.
Is it gay? Is it actually gay?
There's a girl-on-girl kiss in it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if it was actually gay or if it was subtextual gay or if it was the characters are in the same room together at one point and they look hot together, so people started shipping them gay.
And the main character's name is Anita Lesniski, which is short to Needy Les.
Impeccable.
Yeah, so, like, there's a lot of that, and it's really obvious that Needy clearly has some form of repressed feelings for Jennifer, mm-hmm. and Jennifer is so self-assured in her sexuality, and it's really obvious that she's bisexual, and she's also mm-hmm. played by bisexual queen Megan Fox, so...
We love Megan Fox. The world did Megan Fox a disservice.
It really did. And
Michael Bay?
Michael Bay.
I'll fucking kill you.
Evil little bastard man. And after...
He looks kind of like Todd Howard.
Wow. They must be from the same flock. after Transformers, she did Jennifer's Body. And unfortunately, paparazzi snuck in during filming, whatever you want to call it. And... leaked photos of Megan Fox. There's a scene where she swims naked in the lake, but you don't mm-hmm. see anything. And mm-hmm. of course, paparazzi took photos during that scene and leaked them to the internet. So she really felt violated for a good while in relation to the movies. And I don't blame her. And now I think she doesn't really talk about this movie that often, but I think now with the kind of cultural interest in it shifting mm-hmm. in its favor, she's been a little bit more vocal about the experience with Jennifer's Body. And from what I recall, I feel like she has said that she actually really enjoyed this movie a lot, and it's one of her favorites that she's worked on. But what about you? Have you been watching anything fun and sexy?
I rewatched my favorite anime.
Yeah,
I watched Eureka 7, which I cannot recommend enough. Evangelion wishes it was Eureka 7.
That's how I feel about Serial Experiments Lane. Evangelion wishes it was Lane. So I hear you 100%.
For anyone not aware, Eureka 7 is from Studio Bones. The original concept is from Studio Bones, which is really great. I mean, it wasn't like an outsourced or adapted property, anything. It started as an anime. And the way I've been describing it to people is it is a sky surfing mecha ecological cosmic horror romance.
It's on my list because of you. It's time to watch it.
It has really beautiful aesthetics and, like, namings that are all from the 70s. And, like, there's this cataclysmic event in the history that's called the Summer of Love, which I really love that contrast. And it's just, I got the art book in today, and it's, like, 400 pages of, like, mech schematics and character sheets, and it is just so good. And I will say that if you are frustrated or annoyed by teenage characters that act like teenagers, this isn't the show for you, because the lens is all through, like, a 15-turning 16-year-old boy as he, like, grows up and realizes how horrible the world is. And he's not quite like Shinji from Evangelion, where he, like, has these breakdowns. His name is Renton Thurston. He is living in the shadow of his, like, world hero father, and is trying to, like, approach the world with empathy and care, but is also trying to protect and fight for people, and doesn't quite understand how all of these things go together, and realizing that his heroes are not as great as he thought they were. It's just, it's really good. I wholeheartedly recommend it. It is a wild series. It takes some wild turns, and it's just... Also, don't watch the movie, because the movie is an alternate universe. So that's not going to inform anything. It's 50 episodes. Go check it out. I love it.
Okay.
It's beautiful. There's only one filler. There's one filler episode.
Wow, that's actually really sexy. I hate filler episodes.
The filler episode is like they clearly ran out of money.
Oh,
and
no.
And so it's really, it's
is it
kind
a
of
recap
hysterical.
Episode?
It's not a recap.
Oh,
there is
Jesus.
One recap episode, okay. But there's like a really nice narration that goes with it.
Okay.
The filler episode is them playing soccer for some reason.
Oh my God.
And there's like a bunch of shots that are used like over and over again. And the animation is so bad because of course they're saving it all for these like beautiful mech fights and explosions.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a good time.
Delicious. I can't wait. I will watch it just for you.
Jennifer's Body, though,
yeah,
I feel like is going to be relevant to today's topic.
Really? What's today's topic?
Tease.
Yeah?
Put on your clown nose.
Oh,
we're
no!
We're taking a trip to Derry, Maine, so that Cass can talk about it, social media AUs, and Richie Tozier.
Oh, no. Oh, boy. I'm going to have to, like... So, we wanted to do episodes where... we get to kind of geek out about something that we really, really love and think is really special about, like, a certain fandom that we're into. So Cass is going first, and he's talking about the It 2 fandom. And I know very little.
Homophobia the Clown.
I keep calling it Homophobia the Clown, but I will try to not call it Homophobia the Clown.
No, you can call it Homophobia the Clown.
Because are we... But the real question is, when we say Homophobia the Clown, are we discussing Stephen King, or are we discussing Mr. Peepy Wise?
Why not both?
Both.
I will say, I don't... To preface all of this, I'm not a fan of Stephen King. I think we went over this, like, first episode. I mentioned this briefly. Stephen King writes some really beautiful lines sometimes, and I do love a lot of his concepts. But, granted, I have not read any of his recent work. The only stuff I've read Misery, I've read, Dark Towers, I've read, what's the other one I read? Oh, I read Pet Sematary. So that is like, and I've also read On Writing, which is his memoir / bio / writing advice book. So that is my reference point when I talk about Stephen King's writing. I'm not the first one to say that Stephen King doesn't really seem to understand how to write women. There's a Reddit that's entirely dedicated to talking about authors who can't write women. And every day there is a post that says, please stop bringing up Stephen King. We get it.
Oh my God, that's bad.
And I don't know if that's reflected in his earlier work. He is like... pretty he's a great advocate on Twitter. Also, not a great advocate, he's a decent advocate on Twitter, and he has called a certain wizarding author on her bullshit, so I do appreciate that. I do feel like if I met Stephen King in person, he would protect me. That said,
interesting.
That said, we're not really talking about the It book today. I'm not talking about the It book today. I'm talking about the Andre Muschietti movies and related fan properties to those.
Okay.
So, the Muschietti movies are in two parts. The first one is Chapter 1, which came out in 2017. I will go over our list of characters to familiarize yourself with before I describe the movies to you briefly. So, we have Bill Denborough, who is Stephen King's self-insert. He grows up to be a writer, but he is kind of the young leader of the group. He has a stutter. There is Beverly Marsh, who is the girl of the group. So her worst fear in life is getting her period.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. There's Ben Hamscom, who is the pudgy fat kid who is obsessed
Hamscom?
With town history.
His last name is
Hamscom.
Hamscom.
Yeah.
Oh,
Hamscom.
That's
Hamscom. Yeah. It's Hamscom or Hamscom.
That is fat phobia right there, if I ever did.
Stephen King writes fat character, like, I noped out of Misery so fucking quick because it was immediately like, fat people are awful, and I was like, I can't do this. We have Mike Hanlon. He is Black. He grew up in Derry, Maine. He's lost his parents, and his grandfather is raising him. We have Stanley Uris, who is an impeccable little lad. Stanley is probably my favorite. He's young, Jewish. He is very, very sort of proper when he is around adults. He's like the responsible child that all the adults love so much. But then, of course, will like throw swear words around when he's with the rest of the losers gang. Uh-huh. There is Eddie Kasbrak, and Eddie is a tiny child played by Jack Dylan Grazer. And what a perfect casting, because this kid can talk a mile a minute, and Eddie's character is so neurotic. His mother has Munchausen by proxy, and she is smothering in every possible way. Like, this kid is always running around with a fanny pack full of first aid supplies and his inhaler, and will just go off on a second about things being unclean, which we will come back to because it's very important. And then we have Richie Tozier, who is the foul-mouthed, ADD-riddled kid of the group, who can also talk a mile a minute, but is wildly inappropriate and at the same time hyper-intelligent. Chapter 1 takes place when all of the characters are children. We follow Bill Denborough as he pulls the rest of the kids from around town, some of them already his friends, some of them slowly becoming his friends, to search the sewers of Derry, Maine to try and find his lost brother, Georgie. We, as the audience, saw Georgie murdered by a ravenous, monstrous clown at the very beginning of the movie.
Alien clown.
Oh, this clown. This evil, fucking clown.
This little homophobic clown.
This nasty little clown. So, the children come to discover this clown, his name is Pennywise, living in the sewer cistern, which is kind of at the center of Derry, Maine, underground, and they fight to repel it. There is a moment in this movie where Beverly, who is the only girl of the group, is entranced and suspended in the air by Pennywise's deadlights, which is sort of this, like, it's this predator mechanism that he has where he conjures these, like, three rotating balls of light out of his mouth, and, like, the children quite literally float up into the air. So that's where the whole you'll float too thing comes from. Ben, who has had a crush on Beverly the entire time, kisses her to break her out of the deadlights.
Uh-oh.
Whatever. We'll come back to that.
Cass from the future here to jump in and say, I never came back to that. I got too excited to talk about IT fan properties. What I was going to say, though, is there was a perfect moment in the second movie for them to have a cinematic parallel where Eddie kisses Richie to break him out of the deadlights, but they dropped that ball, just like so many others. Anyway, back to the episode. Bye. Thanks.
They defeat, by their assumption, the clown, and then they all decide that they're going to make a blood pact together, which is incredibly unsanitary, where they all cut their palms open and hold hands and promise that if the clown ever comes back, they'll come back too and they'll kill the clown. That movie takes place in 1988 and 1989. So it takes place over, like, the course of a summer. I think it starts in 88 and then there's some, like, time that passes. It's a little nebulous which year in specific it takes place in, but it is very important that it takes place in the late 80s. I'll come back to that too. Chapter 2 takes place in 2016. All the kids have grown up, they've gone their separate ways, a lot of them have become disillusioned and are in really shitty situations. So Beverly Marsh has grown up and has left her abusive father to now be with an abusive husband. Eddie Kasbrak, who left his mother, or she died, who had Munchausen by proxy, is now living with a woman who we only get like 5 seconds of screen time with her, but she looks exactly like his mother. I will also come back to his wife. That needs to be talked about too. Mike Hanlon is the only one who stayed in Derry. This doesn't totally line up, but Mike Hanlon starts to notice that kids are going missing again, so he calls up all of the losers. What is important is that up until the moment that they hear Mike's voice, they have completely forgotten about everything relating to one another and the clown. So that part of their childhood is just poof, it's kind of gone for them until Mike calls, and then all of them kind of have nervous breakdowns. They reunite without Stanley. Stanley has, unfortunately, and we see this on screen, killed himself. They all defeat Pennywise, but in the process, Eddie Kasprak gets murdered by the clown. So, those are the It movies.
Mm-hmm. Which I have seen, so I was able to follow that.
Okay, good. I'm glad. I'm going to go over some brief talking points before I kind of get into the full core of this episode, which is that I want to talk about the implications of Reddy, which is the ship of Richie Tozier and Eddie Kasprak, mm-hmm. what the fandom has done with that, and the subtext slash text of the movie, and how it deals with homosexuality as it relates to horror in general and a real life murder. So, Stephen King, I am asking you politely to please stop making black people and indigenous people your all-knowing sages in movies and in your books. Mm-hmm. Mike Hanlon in It Chapter 2 is really frustrating. And the one thing that, like, I love about these movies is the casting. The casting did a phenomenal job. Like, they picked dead ringer versions of adults for these child actors.
Yeah,
and, like,
I will agree kids, with that.
The kids do such an amazing job. Like, if you want a fun popcorn movie, like, watch the first one. Because the kids are hysterical. They're so good. And apparently they had, like, a lot of fun filming it, which makes me very happy. A lot of them described in interviews that it was, like, one of the best summers of their lives, which just makes me so happy. And apparently they all still hang out with each other, and I'm like, that's really nice.
I just think that's wholesome. Watch the Vines and TikToks. I guess they're Vines at that point. There's so many good videos of those kids offset just hanging out and doing the stupidest shit. I love it. It's
so
good. They're
so fucking funny. Mike Hanlon acting as a sage in the second movie doesn't make total sense, because it's established in the first movie that Ben is the one obsessed with the town's history. Mm-hmm. Like, his walls are papered with articles and newspaper clippings from the entire history of Derry, Maine, because, like, that's his thing. He moves to a new town and all he wants to do is research it. He just goes and hangs out in the library, mm-hmm. because fat kid doesn't have friends. He's so sweet, and I want to protect him. But it's also really frustrating because Mike Hanlon does this thing where he, like, goes and spends time with this indigenous tribe from the area.
I remember and, like, that.
They teach him the ritual.
They and do it's that in also, Dr. Sleep, too.
Right. Well, they do that in Dr. Sleep. It's mm-hmm. it's the same kind of thing in Pet Sematary, where it's like, oh, there's old tribal wisdom here, and, like, these were ancient Indian burial grounds. That's the book's words, not mine. Yikes. But it's just, I understand, especially, I think along the East Coast, at least my experience with education in the public school system was there was a lot of the curriculum that was focused on the indigenous tribes that preceded white settlers in that area, mm-hmm. which, looking back on it now, is really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
for, like, multiple reasons, but I have a feeling that that sort of thing is kind of what has maybe led King to incorporate these sorts of things into his work as a misguided attempt at representation or honorarium, you know?
Yeah.
By no means an excuse. I don't think it's good. I think it's a really bad and toxic trope. But there are people in the fandom who don't want to admit to their racism and say they don't like Mike Hanlon's character because of this, right? Because of this, like, the fact that he lies to the group of losers and says, you know, like, the indigenous people just didn't believe enough. That's why their ritual didn't work, but we'll believe. And, you know, he gets them all into this killer clown's lair because of that. But Miss Beverly Marsh also lied, and people don't hate on Beverly Marsh for lying because she knew Eddie was going to die going into the clown sewer and didn't tell anyone. Just saying.
Yeah.
That's also... I like Bike, which is Mike and Bill Denborough as a ship, but only when the fandom goes with it, because I don't really like Bill Denbrough's character, because in the movie he's just too much Stephen King. He's like he's a dick to his wife, and he's like really obsessed with his own writing, and I'm just like, I don't really care about you. Like, I feel bad for you, but I just don't like you. I love you, James McAvoy, but I don't like you, Bill Denbrough.
Honestly, I forget that Bill is, like, supposed to be the main character of
the fact series. That he fucking goes and meets with Stephen King in the second movie.
Stephen King
appears in a lot of the movies now that are adaptations, and it's, like, it's kind of fun, but also kind of annoying.
It's...
where, like, Bill Denbrough approaches him at the counter, and Stephen King, who is the keeper of this, like, old consignment shop, is like, "You're Bill Denbrough, that author, right? Your endings suck." And it's like, oh my god, I get it, Steven. I get it.
Like, at least in Marvel movies, it's like, hey, it's him. Oh,
it's
my god.
Fun, you know?
I forgot his name. It's Stan Lee. I forgot Stan Lee's name for a second.
Oh, rest in peace, Stan Lee.
It's so. But with Stephen King, I'm like, get away from me, ugly man. I don't want to see you. I do not wish to see you.
I don't need another old white man in my life, you know, Stephen.
Amen. I feel you.
One thing I do love that the fandom has done is that, so, second movie decided that the way to show that Ben Hamscom had become incredibly successful was that he got thin and uber muscular and therefore super hot. A portion of the fandom has said, no. And has picked out an actor that looks more like the child actor than the dude cast in the second movie, and who is, like, still fat, and is, like, really gorgeous. And the thing that's really frustrating about the movie is that it just fails to acknowledge the fact that Ben as a child didn't seem bothered by his own weight. Mm-hmm. He only seemed bothered by it in the capacity that he was being viciously assaulted by the murderous town bullies. Like, it's never something where he's like, oh, I wish I was thinner, or oh, I wish I looked like other boys, or oh, I wish I looked like Bill. It's literally just like, he's just a chubby kid. So I kind of resent the fact that they were like, oh yeah, he grew up and he got really, really buff. And they also just kind of fail to mention that the source material says that Ben kind of became an alcoholic. So, yeah. It also bothers me that, like, that is some sort of, like, visual cue for having achieved happiness for him. Mm-hmm, because, like, you can be fat and successful and fucking hot and happy. Like, none of those things are mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it just shows that, like, how much we just don't value fat people. Like,
mm-hmm.
God forbid a fat person live and exist and is successful while still being fat, you know? Like,
yeah.
Yucky.
And it's a
like
talking
it.
Point in the movie where mm-hmm. he shows up to the reunion and they're like, hey, let's talk about the elephant that's not in the room. And I'm like, yikes, guys.
I remember, like, seeing that in theaters and being like, can we not?
Like, it comes from Richie, so it's kind of in character, but it's also just a little bit like, yikes. Maybe we didn't have to write that in.
Yeah, agreed. So it goes.
Notably, in that scene, Richie also calls him hot, which we'll come back to.
Yeah, boy.
Also, they killed Stanley, like, so early on in the movie, mm-hmm. and they got the perfect casting. I'm just salty.
Does
about
he die that early in the book, too?
I don't think he does, no.
Oh.
No, I think he's alive in the book. Don't quote me on that.
Dang.
But, like, his wife plays a significant role in the book, to my knowledge. And the fandom has done great work with her as well. The fandom, like, works their ass off to include more women in the story, which is really, really great and really fun and amazing. Mm-hmm. There are characters, to my knowledge, that were kind of cut and shoehorned out of the movies, because these are already really long movies. The first one is 2.5 hours long, and the second one is 2 hours and 50 minutes long.
Oh, geez,
so if you're sitting down to watch these,
long. Yeah.
You're looking at watching 6 hours of movies, which my friends didn't know when I roped them into watching them back-to-back with me for the day. Tisa sent me a jazzy little Noctis. It says, jazz for your soul. Thank you.
A friend just sent them to me.
It, Chapter 2, starts off with a really graphic murder.
Yeah.
That is based on a real life murder.
Yeah.
So, in It Chapter 2, we see two men who are boyfriends at the dairy carnival together. And, you know, they're enjoying a fun time. They're on a date. It's really sweet. It's really cute. And then a group of bigots starts harassing them. And then those bigots follow them. And then those bigots push them both off of a bridge. And one of them is drowning in the river. And he sees somebody on the shore, and he's calling out to them. And as his vision kind of unclouds, he sees that it's Pennywise, and Pennywise is eating his boyfriend. And then Pennywise eats him. I maybe wouldn't have so much of a problem with that scene if the movie did not struggle itself to come to terms with the fact that one of its main characters is explicitly gay, as opposed to trying to keep it subtextual, but it's like, it's pretty obvious.
It's obvious.
It's like it is the text, right? Mm-hmm. But it also attempts to be subtextual, mm-hmm. which bothers... It's not willing to own that fully, that Richie Tozier is gay, mm-hmm. and that Richie Tozier is in the closet.
Yeah. Like, if you're a straight, middle-aged woman seeing this, you could put on your little horse blinders and be like, I don't know what Richie's little secret is. I don't know what that initial that he carved into the wood at the end of the movie
I don't
stands
know how
for.
You don't know. I'm going to go over every categorical
feel like,
reason.
I feel like, I mean, my own mother, bless her heart, when we watched Good Omens, I asked her if she thought Crowley and Aziraphale was gay. And she was like, I think they're as close as friends can be. And I was like, Mom... Come on now.
Miss Neens.
So, I mean, that's not fair. Nearly that's as explicit as it is. My mom hasn't actually seen the second part of it, so I can't ask her.
Make her sit down and watch
opinion.
It and watch her and just go, is Richie Tozier gay?
Oh my God.
There is a correct answer.
That's how you know that's the true metric if subtext is too obvious or not. If my mom
the funny
says
thing
it's
is,
true.
So there's like an integral scene that I'm going to talk about then yeah. that the first time I saw this movie in theaters, I had walked out and gone to the bathroom at that point.
Oh,
so
no.
I missed that. So when I came into the fandom, I was like, why is everyone so confident about this?
Oh no.
And then I saw it and I was like, oh, okay. But that scene would also maybe not bother me as much if it wasn't based on an actual fucking murder.
Agreed. Yeah. I felt the same way too.
And there's part of me that understands because, so, to make sure I get this right, in 1984, a man by the name of Charlie Howard, who was gay, was assaulted and murdered by a group of teenagers who threw him into a river in Bangor, Maine. And 1984 is apparently kind of when King was really starting to hit his stride mm-hmm. and, like, coming up as a writer. So this was something that happened in the town he was living in with his wife, and obviously probably would have struck a chord with him and stuck with him. Mm-hmm. That being said, the trauma of real individuals is not your fuel for writing, especially because Stephen King himself is not a gay man. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. that's not really his story to write. And I don't think it is appropriate for him to kind of profit off of that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's appropriate for a movie several years out to decide that they're also going to go that route when they, like, the fact that it is in the exact same methodology in analogously the same location mm-hmm. is what makes it particularly upsetting to me.
Yeah.
Because it's just not respectful of, you know, remaining family members or the legacy of Charlie Howard, you know? Mm-hmm. So, it is, I wanted to bring that up because it is the murdered apparition of one of the victims of this murder who stumbles into Richie at one point during the second movie and hands him a flyer.
That.
Yeah, and calls him handsome. So,
okay, wait, maybe I did realize it and I just am not remembering.
But that scene also doesn't make sense totally on a like, within text movie mm-hmm. basis because Richie doesn't know who that man is, you know?
Yeah.
He's never seen him before.
Yeah.
So it's very much just like a nod to the audience. Mm-hmm. So We only really explore Richie's sexuality in the second movie, thankfully, because Finn Wolfhard is a child. Thank God. I don't think having, like, a big message about sexuality would have been appropriate for the first movie, mm-hmm. which is, by and large, a lot more precocious and adventurous than the second movie is. That said, I think the second movie still struggles to kind of shake off the chains of, like, kid movie, and so it does very much feel like adults having a children's adventure, which works in some aspects because it's the children learning to be adults in the first movie and the adults learning to be kids again in the second movie. But second movie, we have a notable thing where we find out, so Richie Tozier is, like, a very accomplished comedian, and he's touring, and he's, like, in these big, huge theaters. He's doing all sorts of, like, big, huge comedy gigs. And when he meets up with the losers, he mentions that he doesn't write any of his own material, which is kind of notable in the fact that, like, Richie was genuinely funny as a kid, and there's this sort of, like, idea that maybe he sold out a little bit to become as successful as he is. But there's also a second note in there of the sort of inference that because Richie isn't even living his own career, he is, quote unquote, living a lie in two parts, in that one, he's not authentically being himself as a comedian, but he's also not authentically being himself as a human being. Mm-hmm. We see throughout the movie that he is in continual denial of his sexuality. Mm-hmm. In the first movie, when Pennywise fucks with Richie, and in the second movie, when Pennywise fucks with him again, his red balloons are always in the arrangement of an upside-down triangle. And if you are unfamiliar with that, an upside-down pink triangle was the identification symbol that Nazis used for gay men. Mm-hmm. So it's not subtle.
Yeah, like, not a fan.
Yeah, there's parts of me that are okay with that as a symbol, and there's also parts of me that feel that's way too heavy-handed as a symbol, mm-hmm. and it's really, I don't want to say disrespectful, but it just feels like it feels too much. And it feels like, okay, I get it. There's this whole scene that Richie flashes back to as an adult of when he was a child and he was at an arcade and he was playing Street Fighter with another boy. This boy happened to be the cousin of the town's murderous bullies. And there's, like, a little bit of tension in the scene where it's, like, it's framed as, like, a boy with a crush in a mm-hmm. movie. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, he's, like, looking at this other boy while they play Street Fighter. And when the boy's like, okay, well, I gotta head out, Richie pulls up a token. And he's like, oh, do you, like, want to play another game? And he's like, he clearly just wants to spend time with his crush.
Yeah.
But at this exact moment, crush's older cousin rolls up and he turns to his older cousin and starts throwing around some slurs, and older cousin calls Richie the F slur and runs him out of the arcade.
Yep. Yeah.
And Richie runs out into, like, the town center where he's sitting, and there is a Paul Bunyan statue that comes to life and says, "Do you want to kiss, Richie?" It could not be any more obvious at this point.
And that's when Pennywise is like, I know your secret!
Exactly. It then, like, flashes back to him as an adult again, and Pennywise comes floating down from this Paul Bunyan statue with the upside-down triangle of balloons again, mm-hmm. saying, I know your secret, your dirty little secret.
Yeah, oh, that specifically bugged me so hard, because not only is it insinuating that he knows that he's gay, but it's his dirty secret.
Yeah.
And as if it's dirty for being gay. And
oh,
that,
I'm gonna get into that.
Oh, I remember, like, not to go on a tangent, but I remember after I came out of this movie, I saw it with my beard, the love of my life, Straight Boy John.
Straight Boy John!
John, if you ever listen to this podcast, I'm so sorry. All my gay friends know you as Straight Boy John. Forgive me. but I remember coming out of that movie seething. I've been like, how can you treat Richie so dirty this way? Like, mm-hmm. how can you actively, continuously make it an issue and call it dirty that Richie is gay? Like, why yeah. are you giving this signal to audience members who already mm-hmm. have a bad enough issue with homophobia? Like, it just really felt gross to me.
There's a reason for that, mm-hmm. but the reason is so poorly mishandled. Okay, I wouldn't have a problem with them saying dirty little secret, if there was a moment in the movie where it's like, I could see Beverly doing this, where like Beverly has a talk with him mm-hmm. about him being gay
yeah.
and how he doesn't need to be afraid of that. And also talking about the AIDS epidemic, which is huge in this movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I just want some retcon, just a little bit, just a smidge.
Well, I'm going to get into that at the latter portion when I talk about recommendations for media to check out.
Okay.
So, during this scene, Richie is wearing a very specific shirt. mm-hmm. So, Richie in this scene is wearing a yellow shirt, which has upside down, like, dark red crosses all over it. It's patterned with it. This is the exact same shirt that Jesse Walsh was wearing in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which... Let's now talk about Nightmare on Elm Street 2. It's a gay movie.
I've never seen any Nightmare on Elm Street movie before.
So, Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was the first Nightmare on Elm Street. I don't know if there are Nightmare on Elm Streets that now have a final boy, but Jesse Walsh was the first, and he was played by Mark Patton. And Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is largely regarded as an allegorical piece of coming to terms with homosexuality in the midst of the AIDS epidemic. Mm. So it is largely documented as being an LGBTQ horror movie and an allegory for fear and repression of being homosexual. Whenever Jesse is confronted with his own sexuality, that's when Freddy Krueger torments him. So he goes to a gay bar at one point, and he finds his high school coach there, who he ends up murdering. He has, like, this beautiful girlfriend in the movie, and when, like, Freddy starts tormenting him, he doesn't go to her. He goes to his best friend, who is, like, the high school hunk, and he ends up murdering him. There is this whole, like, dance scene that people always point to, where he's, like, gyrating and he's throwing that little GameStop booty back and he's like he's holding a stick out in front of him. There's a scene where Freddy Krueger literally drags his claw and rims Jesse's mouth with it. Like, there it's scene after scene after scene, and this caused a huge issue, and I wholeheartedly recommend that you watch the documentary Scream Queen: My Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm. Which I've heard it's really good.
Yeah, so it's about Mark Patton's experience that he had because of this movie. So when this movie came out, Mark Patton saw immense success. And then overnight, it was either Advocate or The Village that wrote that Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was a gay movie, and tables just turned immediately. So, Nightmare on Elm Street 2 came out in 1985, and this is also kind of when the AIDS epidemic hit its peak. So, Mark Patton was a closeted gay man at this time, and when Nightmare on Elm Street 2 came out, there was suddenly a lot of scrutiny on him, because at this time, actors in Hollywood were subjected to blood tests for filming. Actresses were calling for an end to kissing on set in some cases because they were so afraid of contracting HIV. Mm-hmm. There was this general belief that amongst the gay community that if you didn't see someone in a year, they were probably dead. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the height of the Reagan era, just an awful, awful, terrible thing. Reporters used Mark Patton's closeness to his then partner, Timothy Patrick Murphy, to out Timothy Patrick Murphy as having HIV, and like were invading his hospital room when he was literally laying there dying from AIDS. And like, Jesus. Yeah, Mark Patton like expunged himself from the household because people were coming in to take pictures of Tim like when he was still healthy, because he was doing so well, and like Mark didn't need, like, he was worried that people were gonna find out they were together. Mm-hmm. The country in this period was, and Hollywood specifically, was so aggressive and violent and homophobic. Mark Patton just disappeared.
I don't blame him.
He went off the grid. He, as he says, he moved and lived on a dirt road in Mexico and didn't do acting since. Now, he's a very prominent activist. He speaks openly. Like, this movie is a fantastic gateway. But, I mean, he was victimized, and it was very difficult for him because he felt that the movie had been written in such a... Like, the movie itself was gay from the beginning. Mm. It wasn't him that made it a gay movie because he was gay. It was that the movie... The writer, I think his name's Gaskin, claimed that it was supposed to be a homophobic movie. Yikes. And not a homoerotic movie. Buddy, you failed in that respect. Mm-hmm. This all said, baby Richie Tozier would have seen the aggressive anti-gay reception to Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and toward gay men in general, further coloring his character. And so if Pennywise is an externalization of your fears, then it would make sense why Pennywise calls it his dirty little secret.
That makes sense.
That said, it's not on a textual level enough. It doesn't come up from, like, the undersurface enough for that to not be a problem when you're watching that movie. Like, mm-hmm. because, yes, I do think there are people who can put on their blinders and not realize that Richie Tozier's gay. Like, just removing Eddie Kasprak from the situation. I think there are people who can sit down and watch that movie and not realize he's gay. And so having the implications to AIDS, to the dirtiness of needles, which comes in with Eddie, to the implications of him being closeted as being a dirty secret, like, yeah, that's an issue. That's a huge issue. Horror in general is a reflection of our social fears, mm-hmm. which is why a lot of horror works best in the era in which it was released. I think Midsommar is an excellent example of, you know, kind of examining toxic masculinity and ownership of information. And that movie is not a feminist, though. Oh,
no.
My God.
Feminist, it's not a Pennywise feminist movie.
The amount of people who have decided that Midsommar is like a girl power movie, I'm like, please sit down. It is a white supremacist cult.
I mean, I'm a hardcore Midsommar fan. I cosplayed it at Comic-Con last year. Like, people, like, when Midsommar is, like, synonymous with me at this point, I feel like, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And,
agreed, yeah.
It's just, like, a movie I really, really love. But, like, yeah, it could be a good-for-her movie, but it's not a healthy good-for-her movie.
No.
Like, I hate Gone Girl. I hate Gone Girl so much. And yeah. That's another good-for-her movie, but it's not a healthy mm-hmm. good-for-her movie. And I think sometimes people get swept up in wanting something so badly to be what they hope it is,
yeah.
that they just completely lose all sight of what it's really about, which is how I feel about Jennifer's Body, I think, because so many people desperately wanted it to be what it wasn't, and then when it wasn't what they wanted, they completely shunned it. And I mean, that's just on a huge, large scale. However, with Midsommar is a fantastic movie. However,
oh, it's
oh my God, there are so many things about Midsommar that I could just go on and on about, but I won't do it because we are talking about PPYs. And
save it for its own episode.
One day, I'm just going to have the Midsommar fucking meltdown episode where I just go in. But with Midsommar, people so badly wanted it to be a movie about healing. And it is, to some degree, but also it's about being susceptible and vulnerable and taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people actually miss that. So to get off that tangent, let's go back to it.
Yeah, so horror being a reflection of societal fears, we also have to take into account that horror and film in general also regularly pose queerness as being monstrous and mm-hmm. evil.
Yes.
People who are gay are often the murderer or they are the monster. I mean, like, look at Buffalo Bill. Mm-hmm. There's Dress to Kill. But very rarely do we examine, you know, sort of queerness as being the reality within and that kind of being its own sort of fear when you are, you know, a queer individual in a world that is not welcoming to you.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, what does it say of our society and of our culture when Richie Tozier can't openly and verbally admit to his dearest friends mm-hmm. about being gay and even struggles to admit it to himself?
Mm-hmm.
I do think that there's this weird sort of fulfilling representation I find in Richie, in that you have a man who has a career, who has an established life, but who hasn't taken the time for himself and to look at himself and to come to terms with himself, as scary as that might be. Mm-hmm. There could have been another I would watch a movie just about Richie Tozier, and I would love to see Bill Hader do it because he's a phenomenal actor.
He did a great
job. But I
job.
Will watch Barry instead. Because Barry's better.
Yeah.
I think kind of walking backward a little bit to talk about Eddie then. Eddie is this hyper-neurotic child, victim of an obsessive mother who's abusive, who has Munchausen by proxy, who... he just sort of orbits Richie, and they are these, like, fantastic character foils in that Richie has loving and supportive parents who, you know, we don't necessarily see, but he is, like, the free-spirited child. He doesn't think about anything. Anything he wants to say just comes right out of his mouth, including in front of adults. And then Eddie has to, like, embody this perfect behavior in front of his mother and keep up appearances at all times. And there's just, like, there's a really great dynamic there between the two of them. And it, as child actors, Finn Wolfhard and Jack Dylan Grazer did a fantastic job playing off of one another. Like, they're fun to watch. Mm-hmm. Like, as two characters, like, fucking with each other constantly, like, Richie is always riling up Eddie, and Eddie is, like, always giving into it and, like, letting off, like, a string of swear words, which is, there's something about children swearing that is just so funny and entertaining to me. It's just great.
It feels real, like, their friendship feels really realistic to me because I had friends like that growing up. Mm-hmm. I was the one who was usually riled up by all of my friends. And I still am today. You could literally make you can make eye contact with me and say that I suck toes and I'll just, like, freak out on you. Literally. It's so bad. Like, especially at cons, if I, like, am only on 4 hours of sleep, like, literally someone's going, "You're gonna suck some toes." I'm like, yeah! It's true. So I see it. Like, seeing it in mm-hmm. theaters and seeing them interact, it felt so real. And
yeah.
The actors are so good. Like, there's, and even both, like, the children and the adults, they both yeah. have such a set of chemistry that only really can be formed by people who know each other too well and love each other very deeply.
PJ Ransone and Bill Hader. It's also just, like, funny because, like, Bill Hader's, like, this big dude. Mm-hmm. He's, like, 6'2". I resent that he's just a little bit taller than me.
It's okay. I feel that way about you. I love
Bill Hader.
Guys, if I met Cass is Bill Hader in me, person, it makes me so mad.
I'm like a horse where I always want to be the tallest thing around.
That's how
I
feel.
So if someone's taller than me, I feel threatened.
I remember at Anime NYC this year, we both, like, paused and made eye contact with each other, and we were like, "How tall are you?" And begrudgingly, I realized you were taller than me.
Well, so I'm 6'1", and then I also tend to, like, the boots that I wear everywhere mm-hmm. have 3-inch heels on them.
Yeah, and I'm 5'11". Like... Oh, God damn it.
My supremacy.
I know. I usually wear, like, docks, which are about 1.5 inches. So yeah. I'm always, or I'm wearing creepers, and that's a 2-inch. Actually.
Creeper.
Actually, two years ago today, the day that we're recording, I was cosplaying Tokyo Mew Mew, and I was wearing my creepers. And some guy made eye contact with me. He's like, "You're pretty tall, aren't you?"
I was like, he too felt threatened.
Yeah, I guess he just wasn't expecting to see some very high femme, because I was cosplaying Zakharos and mm-hmm. maid uniform, so, like, that was super high femme for me, just clomping around 6'2".
Harsh time.
Yeah, and, like, even straight boy John, I met up with him and his friends, and they were like, "We honestly didn't realize it was you. We're like, who is this attractive girl talking to us?" And I was
wow.
like, "No, it's okay. Like, I'm one of the boys in that group." So I was like, "Yeah, sorry, guys. I guess my dyke ass can look good once in a while." Like, thanks.
boys, we need to have a talk about femininity and femness not being analogous to attractive.
It's okay. They won't understand. It's no big deal. I'll suck it up.
Anyway, Bill Hader's very tall, and James Ransone, or PJ Ransone, is very short. So next to each other, it's just... The fact that Wardrobe did so great with Bill Hader, and then looked at Eddie's character and went, yeah, we're gonna put you in some, like, really slouchy pants, and he dresses like a child. Like, he dresses like a man who never learned to dress himself, and I'm sure on the part of Wardrobe that was intentional, and, like, kind of works, because this man, like, in narrative went from living with his mother to living with ostensibly, like, a carbon copy of his mother. Mm-hmm. Which, the fandom doesn't quite know what to do with Eddie's wife, Mira, and so sometimes that manifests as the sort of usual fandom misogyny of, like, choosing to make her really homophobic. Mm-hmm. And I don't really love that. But because there's literally just not enough in the movie for us to know her character. But there's not enough for us to know her character.
Mm-hmm. Eskel, who's your favorite It character?
He says Beverly.
Wow.
He's got good taste.
Good taste.
I too love Jessica Chastain, Eskel. One of the notable things with Eddie is that when Pennywise torments him, there is this moment where he's, like, walking through the basement of a drugstore, and he is surrounded by filthy medical.
That scene all is of, so gross.
It's so nasty. All of Eddie's, like, fears kind of circulate around disease and just body horror and medical horror in mm-hmm. general, and his inability to control those things.
Yeah.
But the presence of needles in general is another thing that the fandom has kind of said, yeah, this is probably another, like, point towards AIDS epidemic, mm-hmm. you know, repressed homosexuality kind of deal. It is, like, the way in which Eddie and Richie interact with one another does seem to maybe suggest that it is a two-way street. There is a moment when Eddie is bleeding out and dying at the end of the movie where he says he wants to tell Richie something, and he, like, keeps stuttering because he's coughing on his own blood. And you're like, oh, he's going to tell him he loves him. And then he says, I fucked your mom.
Yeah.
And it
sure
is
does.
So frustrating. It's so enraging. But there is a fandom author who took that line and used it really fucking well.
Okay.
So, I would like to highlight some really incredible fanfictions and talk briefly about social media AUs in the It fandom, because the It fandom is what showed me social media AUs. Social media AUs largely take place, it seems like, through text messages, mm-hmm. which is a really kind of fun and easy breezy way to read a fic and digest a story. I'm going to leave my cat meowing in here. He needs to be heard. He's totally fine. He just wants attention. Can I help you? The very first one that I ended up reading was by an author who I'll mention later, which is, like, an acting AU, and I talked about this in episode one, and I do encourage back listening on our podcast, because why the fuck not? Go back and listen. Go back and have some more fun time with Cass and Tease. Mm-hmm. We're your friends. We're here with you.
We're your good pals.
There's something that, in a social media AU, where if the writer can capture the character's voice as well, it feels so genuine and so comforting, because it also satisfies this, like, weird part of me that loves to see other people's interactions. Like, mm-hmm. I'm the person on the subway who, if I don't have my own thing to do, I will read your text messages over your shoulder.
Oh, God, me too. Same. Sorry, everybody.
I think everyone does it. Everybody does it in New York. Anyone yeah. who ever takes public transit. Like, if someone's sitting next to you and you can read their phone screen, you'll read their phone screen.
Yeah.
So, like, social media AUs, like, satisfy that part of me that, like, wants to see, like, my friends' conversations and how they interact. And then what I noticed with the It fandom is that there's also a lot of cross-media stuff. So they will continue to build out their universes and their plot lines by adding either videos that they have edited themselves, they will put together, you know, Instagram feeds, or they will make IMDb pages or Wikipedia pages. They'll write articles. There's a really compelling academic AU that has like all sorts of medical journals and like grant proposals that have been written up by the characters, which is just like, it's really wild.
That's and impressive.
It's so incredible. That being said, because of this, social media AUs are unfortunately not the most accessible. Mm-hmm. There are some writers who are very good about adding alt text to their images because largely these are taken as like phone screenshots. Mm-hmm. If you happen to be a writer listening to this and you write social media AUs, I would encourage you to make sure you're making alt text for all of your stuff. I know it's exhausting for you and that it might be a lot of extra work. It is worth it to make your work more accessible to more people.
It literally takes me an hour to transcribe 10 minutes worth of audio. So sometimes I'm doing up to like 7 hours worth of audio transcription to get one episode out, but it's worth mm-hmm. it because I know people will appreciate it, you know, yeah. people who are hard of hearing, people who have auditory processing issues, so on and so mm-hmm. forth. So highly recommend working on alt text. And like, I know I have my own issues with doing alt text myself, but like, if you just get into the habit of it, it just yeah. becomes second nature. Highly mm-hmm. recommend.
And more people get to enjoy your work then, which I think yeah. is really important. Like, you, not only do people deserve to get to experience your work deserves to be appreciated by everyone, mm-hmm. no matter their preferences of engagement.
Yes.
So, here are some fics and properties within the It fandom that I would like to recommend. I limited myself because otherwise I would go on forever. Mm-hmm. So, if you are an author listening to this and I haven't mentioned you, I maybe haven't found your fic, or I maybe haven't read it yet. But also, please, if you are listening and you know of other really engaging or compelling fics or social media AUs, feel free to send them to me because I would love to check them out. There's something about these characters that are really comforting to me, and it is very nice both to be able to explore fan-made media that handles sexuality and coming to terms with one's sexuality in really adult, empathetic, understanding, and honest ways. And all of these properties are from other adults. I don't engage with the teenage portion of the fandom because there is a teenage portion of the fandom. And if somebody is talking about how attracted they are to a child actor, I'm like, that person is 14. I'm not gonna talk to them. Mm-hmm. When people are like, Finn Wolfhard's so cute, I'm like, that's
how
gross.
Old are
He's
you?
A child. And I'm like, oh, your profile says you're 13.
Like, get, you can say, like, a teenager is cute, they're a great actor
yeah,
or whatever, but,
yeah.
like, if you're, like, in love with them, like, mm-hmm. if you're, like, some Tiger Beat teen pop poster shit,
yeah,
then
that's
you're
what
clearly
I'm talking
a
about.
Child. Get yeah. away from me.
There's something very funny to me about fan cams of children. So the first one I want to mention is Unbroken Line. It's a horror social media AU. You can find it on Twitter at @unbrokenline_AU, and that is by Twitter user at @RorschachIsGay. He is a gay writer. His name is Rance. I really love his writing. He seems like a cool, chill dude. He has also made some really popular stuff within the fandom that you are probably familiar with if you're a part of It fandom. So, Unbroken Line is also framed within the context of filming, and it sort of, it looks at the It properties and says, okay, what if these were movies that the children had been involved with as child actors making this story and then revisited as adult actors to make like a reunion kind of movie with like some different plot elements and stuff. It's told through text messages, and it includes web articles, edited video sequences, there's pages of the movie script, and a lot more. And it took the I fucked your mom scene, and it used it way better than Andre Muschietti could, where, like, there's this scene where, if I'm remembering it correctly, Eddie and Richie are, like, in the sewers, and they're like lost and separated from each other, and they're both communicating with, like, apparitions of the other that are like twisted by the horror landscape and like trying to convince each other that like they're the real version of themselves, and like they use the "I fucked your mom," and it just like
wow,
it works. Ooh. So well. Ooh, it wow. works so well.
That sounds really good.
Unbroken Line is also nice in that it doesn't have a subplot where it's like Eddie struggling to admit that he's gay. He just is. It's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I don't want to read about struggling with sexuality.
Agreed.
I deal with that enough in my own life.
Amen. So, I feel
Unbroken Line, it is a horror AU. It's good though. The second one fucks me up consistently. It's called Aberration. It is available on Twitter at @aberration_AU, and it's from Twitter user at Chernobrew. I think I'm pronouncing that Chernobroch. Chernobroch. The description for the AU itself is:
in 2037, Marcus Purnell hosts a semi-popular YouTube series where he talks about the history of TV shows of the past. When he gets requested to cover the 80s show Wilkes Law, starring the late Richie Tozier, he gets flung into a mystery of a lifetime.
It is an archival uncovering of the pasts of these characters in like just this like wildly different alternate universe that's very grounded in reality. It is framed heavily around loss and death, but in a very accepting and beautiful way. It includes audiovisual pieces, handwritten letters, and text messages, and the handwritten letters that are exchanged between characters, and there are diary entries as well, are so beautiful and so poignant to the point where like I saved the image of one and I was sending it around to people and I was like, please read this because it is just absolutely gorgeous. And they're like, what's it from? And I'm like, it's from an It fan fiction. Don't worry about that part though. Read this. it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautifully done.
That's wonderful.
It is. Cut the Strings is available on Twitter at @stringscut, and it's by Twitter user at @SlavicEddie. And it is a speculative AU that sort of fiddles with the idea. Well, it doesn't fiddle with the idea. It is following the lives of the tortured nightmare versions of the loser characters if they were themselves conscious and had to live life after Pee-Pee Clown died. So,
wow.
Like, there's, like, this version of Richie that is, like, this ventriloquist dummy. So it's like, what if he actually aged and came to life? There's a version of Stanley's head that pops out of a fridge and has spider legs and is monstrous. And it's like, that's alive. That's a character.
I don't
We're
like
gonna explore that.
That.
And like Beverly Marsh's like apparition that like combusts into flame and is like full of anger. And like, how do these characters deal with the fact that their other halves have like gained freedom and happiness? Mm-hmm. And how do they find that for themselves? It's really interesting. It's really cool.
Is the Nakey Lady recommend. In it?
The Nakey Lady's not in it.
Damn it.
That woman is terrifying. Oh.
When the first trailer for It 2 came out and they showed her, I was like, what is scary about being naked in your own home? That is me on the daily. But then I was like, all right, but what if, like, you just were trying to have a cup of tea and then some random lady did get naked in her apartment and you were trapped in there? I was like, all
exactly.
right. That exactly. is kind of scary.
This next one is not a social media AU. It is just like a traditional fan fiction. It's called Cherry Vodka, and it is available on Archive of Our Own. It's by user Leslie, but Leslie is spelled with, it's L-V-S-L-I-E. So, Leslie. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Cherry Vodka is the description of the fic is:
American screenwriter Richie comes to shoot a movie in late Soviet era Poland and meets Eddie Kay, sound technician and hobbyist car mechanic.
This is one of those fics that you read and you wish it were a book that you pulled off the shelf at a bookstore. Okay. It is self-contained because it is so removed from it. There's no horror in it. It is just a total AU and exploration of these characters. It is so very much a lovingly crafted evidence of a lived experience of what Soviet era Poland was like. And this writer themselves is Polish. Just it paints such a beautiful, honest picture of that time period. And I mean, the references to, you know, the times, they're both accessible and compel you to do some deeper research. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a really fantastic fic. It's 25,000 words. It's deeply personal. It's very grounded and earnest. It doesn't, you know, hem and haw about, you know, are they gay? Aren't they gay? It is just like this really soft and tender slow burn. So there's an animated short by animator Patty Smak, who is also Polish, that's really beautiful, that I encourage you to check out. It's great. If anything, maybe watch Patty's short as a sort of teaser, and then read the fic. It's great, though. Mm-hmm. I got two more.
Okay.
One ain't even a fan fiction. Uh-huh. So the other one, though, before we get to that. Unfortunately, this one is titled after a line in Hamilton. It's called, now what I'm going to say may seem indelicate, and that is by If It Hollers. It's available on Archive of Our Own. It is still in progress. So if you're not here for in progress fix, maybe not. But it is like very lengthy at this point. So like you got a while to catch up. It is a fantastic examination and exploration of what Richie and Eddie's relationship may have looked like if Eddie survived. And it is laced with this very honest trepidation, questioning, and conflict, which feels undeniably real despite the killer clown circumstances. So it is also immaculately tagged. Every single chapter has like just very, very detailed warnings for every possible thing in it that could be upsetting to people, because it does deal a lot with medical trauma and body horror, because Eddie got stabbed through the chest by a giant clown crab claw. So there's obviously some surgery stuff that happens there. The beginning portion of the fic takes place like in the hospital while Eddie is like struggling to recover, and something about the way Richie is characterized just felt so, I keep saying the word honest, but like that is the one prevailing thing that a lot of the writers in this fandom do a great job of, is just honesty of character, of what it's like to be in a hospital when someone you love is in not even critical condition anymore, but just to be in a circumstance where you're floating in this weird sort of halfway point where you can't do new things and you can't return to old things. You are just sort of stuck in this purgatory.
Oh, there's a line in Hoseki no Kuni, and it is, I can actually read it to you directly.
Please do.
Give me a hot second. And every time I think of it, it absolutely kills me. And it's, since you cannot return to how you were now, you must become better. You'll just have to mm-hmm. become better. And that always hits me so hard, because it's like these experiences that you have afford you a new outlook, and what you decide to do with this outlook is shows what kind of person you are. And when media tackles that, it always just hits me so hard. Well, oh my god.
And this fic, like, it's that in a nutshell, because it's Eddie who is like, okay, I died on the table multiple times, I wasn't happy in my old life, I'm a gay man, I'm tired of not choosing things for myself. You know, I've had a wife who's picked everything for me, I had a mother who's picked everything for me, I'm finally deciding I'm going to pick things for myself. But being in a place where he can't necessarily, because he has to abide by doctor's orders, and he has friends who are mother henning him, and it's just, it's really great. I would definitely recommend checking it out. The last one,
yes,
is a video game.
Excuse me?
Somebody, not somebody, Sophia Zhu, who also goes by Maypearl Syrup, Maypearl is spelled M-A-P-U-R-L, made a game called Use Your Outside Voice, Richie Tozier. It takes about an hour to play. It's totally free to play. You can download it. It's available on all operating systems. It is a fix-it ending to the movie.
Nice.
And it has a conversation between you, the player, and Stan, the narrator, Stanley Uris, who killed himself at the beginning of the second movie, about the choices we make and the bravery that is inherent in both our sacrifices and in fighting predetermined narratives.
Wow. That's really
cool. It's good. It's good. It is, I mean, it's a very simple game. You know, it's it has, like, it follows, like, the final moments of the movie, and it's sort of a, it's not really, like, a Groundhog Day, it's like a, oh, you weren't happy with that ending? Well, here, let's go back and do it again. And you go back and you do it again, and they're like, what, why aren't you happy with this? I gave you the thing you wanted. Oh, it wasn't enough? Okay. Well, at some point, you're gonna have to choose, you know, what makes you happy and what is excessive. It's just... So, hi. This episode has been my love letter to the It fandom. You're all pretty great. I've lurked amongst you for a while, and it's been really wonderful. And you all create some really incredible, engaging, amazing content out of a source material that is deeply troubled and doesn't know what it wants to say.
I'm so glad you got to do this.
Tease, do you have any questions about Richie Tozier? I'm ready to answer them.
No. I don't... I don't think I do.
Richard Wentworth Tozier.
How did you feel... Okay, I guess spoilers for the movie, because how did you feel in that last scene where he does in fact...
Oh, I didn't even talk about that.
Yeah, because boy howdy, even like me at the end of that movie was like, goo 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 goo. Like, it just hurt, boys. It hurt so bad.
At the very end of the movie, right? We... You watch Eddie die and pull the I fucked your mom line. And Richie is so visibly just like breaking down right there in front of him. And as the losers are like rapidly trying to escape, they're like, we can't carry him out of here. Like, we have to leave him behind. And Richie doesn't want to. Richie is like desperately trying to like be like, no, we can save him. Richie, he's got a gaping wound in the middle of his chest, bud. So they tear him out. And then they go to the quarry, and they're all swimming together, and it's like they're kids again. And Bill Hader, Richie Tozier, is sitting up on a rock, and Bev and Ben are underwater kissing, and poor Richie just loses it and starts sobbing. And none of the rest of them are not crying, but they all come over to hug him, and it's just like... He's so obviously stricken with grief. And then he goes back to this bridge in Derry that was like clearly a lover's bridge. And he retraces these carvings that he did as a child with a penknife of his and Eddie's initials. Like, come on! What the hell?
They're in love.
It's so sad. It's so sad. So not only did this movie decide to make the very first visible murder a hate crime, they based it off a real hate crime, and then they couldn't even do justice by its gay character and allow him a shred of happiness. Like, he couldn't even get a moment where Eddie's like, oh, I love you. It's, I fucked your mom.
Mm-hmm.
Come on!
Yeah, I just wish for a little bit more. Just a little.
But yeah. Those are my feelings on It. I have a lot more.
Yeah.
But it's an hour and 20 minutes, and Tease will kill me.
We can always just talk about it off recording.
Listen.
Yeah. I'm listening.
All that said, if you have any fic recs, or if you have any questions about It, or you want to talk to me about It, or you have questions or ideas for topics in general for this podcast, we would love if you would reach out to us. We're available on Twitter at AuthorsNotePod, and you can also reach out to us via email at AuthorsNotePod@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Tease, if people want to get in contact with you directly, where can they find more of you?
You can find me at Vicunad, V-I-C-U-N-A-D. Our music was produced and created by James Wyulo. You could find him on Bandcamp at James Y.
And if you're interested in more of my work, you can find me at Valhethella on Twitter. That's V-A-L-H-E-T-H-E-L-L-A. If you enjoyed the episode, we would really love if you could recommend us to a friend or leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. That would be super appreciated. If you want to support us more directly, you can support us fiscally on Ko-fi. We are at AuthorsNotePod there as well. Our cover art is by the wonderful Nyaliest. You can find more of her work on Twitter at Nyaliest. That's N-Y-A-L-L-I-E-S-T. Thank you so much for joining us, and until next time, stay safe.